Welcome to the 2024 September 4th Van County Board of Supervisors meeting, and we'll now have our pledge of allegiance.
Pledge of allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Did you have some thoughts?
Yeah, there's a couple things for adoption of the agenda. So we have to pull two items under 8C, under action. We need to pull authorization to advertise dangerous dog ordinance update. I think Mr. Witten had noticed that there's a few other updates that need to be changed and then made to that.
Correct. So back in 2021, when the state code was amended, they not only amended the code section, they also added four other code sections. So I think we need to incorporate some of that language into our local ordinance.
So we'll pull that one. In addition, pull item under consent 10Q, CRMF, Treasurer's Office, HVAC. I think Public Works has found a more reasonably priced option to fix that. So we're going to pull that. And then one item that we may want to add to unfinished business is a discussion, just if the board is interested in doing a solar committee ordinance update, just so you kind of understand where the solar committee is. Again, it's going to be going to the planning commission next week, and then it'll, you know, go to the board subsequently after that. But just if you're interested in kind of seeing where the current ordinance is, and then we can go from there.
So Eric and I talked about it, and you know, we got a light agenda, so it'd be a good place to put it. And it's just the importance of maybe not having too much conversation about it, so we're not kind of preempting the planning commission. And so, everybody good with that?
So, Mr. Chair, I move that we strike item C from action matters, item Q from the consent agenda, and add non-finished business item for solar committee update.
Second. Motion made by Mr. Hawes, second by Mr. Chair. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0. Administrator's report.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, board, a few things to report. I also want to welcome a few new employees. Taylor Campbell, she started as a benefits program specialist August 19th for the Department of Social Services. Walter Obey started as a grounds maintenance worker for Public Works. He started August 26th. Pamela Staten, Human Resources Generalist for Human Resources, started August 26th. Henry Vandenbroek, as HVAC Apprentice for Public Works, started August 26th. And want to certainly welcome all those new employees to county staff. And then just real quick, we just have some upcoming meetings. So Wednesday, September 18th, we have a 6 p.m. regular meeting. Wednesday, October 2nd, we have a 5 p.m. regular meeting. And then Wednesday, October 16th, we have a 6 p.m. regular meeting. Happy to answer any questions on the board.
Questions?
Is he related to William?
Yes.
Thought so.
Walter. All right. Anything else?
Nope.
Great. All right, we'll have our first round of public comment. Anyone wishing to address the board, please come to the podium, say your name and address. Please remember to keep your comments 5 minutes on topic and direct to the board. Anybody wishing to address the board? Seeing none, we'll close first round of public comment. Next item is presentations. Item A, VDOT quarterly report. Mr. Scott Thornton, Residency Administrator, Louisa Residency.
Chairman, board members, staff, how are y'all tonight?
Good.
So I've got a fairly light report as well.
And then just one thing, I think the report that you have, each of the board members has a copy
yes.
in front of them.
Yeah, we were a little bit delayed. My apologies with the holidays and kind of the end of the month running like it was. So you have the report, it is not in the packet. And I also have an extra copy up here for staff when I'm done. So our maintenance crew has been working through normal summer activities. You may have noticed primary mowing has been completed throughout the county. Our secondary mowing is ongoing, and we're probably about 80% complete in the county right now, continuing work on that. Our scheduling resurfacing is completed, but we are having some pavement mark, remarking is done, and that should be going on through the end of October, mid-November, which is typical for this time of year. Traffic studies has been provided by the board for Route 15, Route 6, as well as Dottie Creek. Those are all ongoing right now. And we don't have any active construction bridge projects at this time, although there are a few being looked at for Route 672 in the coming future. Did want to spend a little bit of time previewing the upcoming transportation alternatives and revenue sharing funding cycle that's upcoming. So the pre-application period for that starts April 1st of next year and runs through May 31st with full application being open from August 15th to September 15th of next year. So we're looking to start having meetings for that cycle towards the end of the month in my office. So staff will be getting some emails for those meetings, probably looking the week of September 16th, 17th. There are a few changes to the program this year. So all TAP projects must be in the capital improvement plan for the localities. TA funding is also capped at $2.5 million. This is not a cap on the total cost, but just a cap on the match. So if the project is higher, it's going to require more of a local match. They're not going to allow localities to reapply. So if there's a poor estimate, so used to be you could apply for additional funding in a subsequent cycle, they're not going to allow that anymore. So that's another one of the things for these meetings, is we're going to talk about really nailing down that estimate as well as building in inflation adjustments moving forward. There's also going to be a section for what they call reasonable progress requirements. This has things in it like 50% of the PE funds must be spent within the first 2 years. Invoices must be received at least quarterly. There are other items on there, and I didn't want to steal all the local assistance groups thunder for providing everything at this meeting. There are also going to be, after we have a meeting in September, there are going to be district visits in October where our local assistance folks as well as our programming planning staff are going to come down and visit with the localities. One of the things we had talked about is internally to VDOT, we can sit down and meet and talk about an intersection, pull it up on a map, but myself and the other resident engineers in the district, we really felt like it's a benefit to sit down, meet with staff, go to that location, meet with anybody to really get an idea of what the problem we're trying to solve is. And then if there is a request for assistance from VDOT, whether that be the design, the estimate, administration of the project, we're asking that those requests be in by about mid-November, November 15th or so. And all this is, again, going to be discussed at that meeting, but I did want to kind of preface that because I know, you know, folks are starting to think about the budget, get those things in the plan, especially with pre-app being right around the time most localities are going through the budget cycle, so that we can be thinking about those projects and kind of getting those, you know, to kind of prime the pump for that discussion for those meetings in September. So, you know, if you had any projects that would be, you know, transportation alternative revenue sharing, those are like a 50% match or your 80-20 matches, you know, send them to me, send them to staff, and that way we can kind of have that discussion and get those projects in line to the visits in October. So that's all in my report.
Taylor Ridge Estate on the entrance off Route 53. I had two others that I forwarded to the chair. If you could look at for me on Lake Monticello Road, which is State Route 618, at the intersection of Manor Boulevard, which is County Road 1110, there's no 25 mile an hour speed limit sign as you enter that neighborhood. And the same thing holds true off Lake Monticello Road, State Route 618, and Village Oaks Boulevard, which is County Road 1115. There's no 25 mile an hour speed limit, and the people think that neighborhood's 45 miles an hour, and they do bomb through there.
And I already sent them this afternoon, I sent it without the addresses in it.
Yeah.
So, okay, so that's the same.
The same, yeah.
Gotcha.
And there's know if you'd be concerned about this. At the intersection of Mandible Road and Canal View, which is 1110 and 1111, there's erosion at the edge of the road and the pavement's starting to break up. So that might be something to look at if you could save some money on pavement instead of it keep getting worse. And it's on a slope, so when it rains, the rain goes down along the side of the road, and I don't think it had adequate cover to keep it from the road away.
Take a look.
I know we talked about this before. I think we talked about it with you. Carriage Creek. Mm-hmm. Just a number count. That's still a dirt road, one of the few we have left in the county, but they have added, they're in the process of adding probably 10, somewhere between 10 and 15 homes.
You beat me too.
I look at you to go first.
Well, I didn't know you were going to bring up something in my district.
And this one, I'm not sure if this is in your district or not. Because Ferncliff exit that's in Louisa in your district,
yes.
All the 64.
Mm-hmm.
I brought it up to some of the Louisa supervisors. I'm not sure if they brought this forward to you.
Mm-hmm.
In the evening, but that means something needs to be done with that exit ramp from the eastbound lane. Traffic comes up and they've made it into a two-lane exit ramp, even though it's a one-lane exit ramp. Cars come by in the emergency lane 50 miles an hour. I don't know how you address that, or that's just something that I see, because that's the exit we use, but I use it a lot with the driver's ed kids. And we've almost been hit twice because I make them stay in line. And as we go to turn right, here comes somebody 45, 50 miles an hour in the emergency lane. So I don't know how you address that, whether it's law enforcement gets involved or...
It's probably a combination of law enforcement or pavement markings, but
Like I said, just something that sooner or later is going to be an issue there. Somebody's going to get hit, and it's going to be hopefully avoidable.
Yep, I'll pass it along to the traffic engineer.
Right.
I got one in Louisa, one in 14.
Which district are you in? Which county?
Me and Fitzgerald would like this letter.
Just to piggyback, I think Eric, you had sent me an email. Was it Mr. Thornton was on the email?
Yeah, from Carriage Creek.
For Carriage Creek, the last time they did a study, which was a little less than a year ago, it was more recent than I thought, and there was 40.
Yep.
What do we need, 50?
50.
So the last count was done,
I think you said May of 2024.
May of 2024. May 19th, I think, was
yep.
the actual date, if I recall.
Mr. Spencer needs to go home and check his laundry or something.
So I have requested another count to be done in the fall to see if we can get those numbers.
I'm not sure if any more houses have been completed, but I know they're in the process of being
built. And you said rural rustic. What is that? What different type of paving or?
It's our paving place program. So it's a tar and chip pavement. It is a hard surface road. They're not going to go in there with a traditional paver,
mm-hmm.
2 inches of asphalt. But generally, it's the road as it sits. Our crews will go in there. They'll trim, the branches that are overhanging the road, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe replace any cross pipes that need to be done. But they're not going to go in and widen the road or anything
right.
like that.
Yeah.
And then they'll build up where they need to, any stone, and take care of any separate issues, and then tar and chip the road with a, like you would see in a subdivision.
Yeah,
a company, put that down, and the road's posted at 35 miles an hour.
Speaking of that, I knew you were going to try some additional measures to mitigate the dust there.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, any update there with those?
So we're going through, as we cycle our tanks with the calcium car, we cycle our tanks, pump the water off, and then put it out, but there's, it's just been dry. I'm hoping that between the rain and the favorable conditions, that's
maybe
kind of a charm of living on a gravel road, because you got to deal with it.
Yeah.
But we are going out there periodically, but it's not something that I can constantly just pump water, put it out on one road. But we are monitoring, especially when we get these long dry spells.
Yeah.
I think when Mr. Dahl sent me the email, I think it rained the very next day. So.
Yeah,
we've got our tanker loaded up. They loaded it up that evening, so if we get another dry run, they'll go out there and put it down. But yes, every time we cycle our tanks, which we have to do at least once a month, they're loading the excess to put.
And that's on any of, I mean, I know your email said it was still in production. Any updates since then?
Until we actually get it in Culpeper District, I won't get any updates. It's in fabrication, and once we get it delivered, they'll tell me when it's scheduled.
I know it's on the other one in the meantime.
It's funny, there's the ones they keep in stock and the ones they don't.
Yeah.
So some of them, like another one for Mr. Fairchild, I believe it was like 2 days.
Literally like 2 days.
Yeah, and then some of them, they take a while, so.
And did we get the 55 signed post on Remo Road yet?
Don't
you know what?
I don't think so. I haven't had anything from traffic engineering to say.
I do have young brother signs. I got one behind. I brought this one up a couple of years back. And 40-mile-an-hour speed limit. As you turn at the bank on the courthouse and you start up the hill, when you get to the top of the hill, you'll see a sign on the other side of the road that says 40 miles an hour. The road, the sign is, it used to be one up there that said end 40 mile an hour. The sign broke, I don't know how many years ago, and it's never been put back up. That makes sense. It's right, I guess, probably 200 feet west of the intersection of George's Mill and Courthouse.
I know you always hear, do this, do this, do this. Thank you for getting the 35 mile an hour sign up in, at the old firehouse in 14.
Just one thing I wanted to bring to Bruce's attention. So, and this, I know this was discussed during the retreat. So, the 14 streetscape. So, when the project was originally done, and it was a, if I remember correctly, the original grant that the county got was a TAP grants, gosh, back in 2013, 14, or something like that.
Back to first year, I was on board.
Yeah, and so there was a portion, so when it was put out to bid, there was only so much money, and there was a portion between Pettit Foster and Academy Road that was an ad alternate to the original project. That part was not completed, or was not, the bid to do that piece, the money wasn't there, so the board never finished the Pettit Foster to Academy Road sidewalks and streetscape. But the plans, the design, and everything, it looks like everything is there, ready to go. So the question is, I know there's a thought to, you know, move more of the 14 streetscape process forward. After speaking with Mr. Thornton here, now that we've got basically plans ready to go, that might be a good eligible project to try and move forward sooner than later, because the plans are there. It just wasn't funded previously. The funding wasn't there. So I talked to Mr. Thornton about including that as a TAP grant application. Currently, it's not in our CIP, but from what I'm understanding.
Right, it would have to be in
CIP
to qualify. And like I said, we talked about this internally as a department. Projects like that, they have a plan in place. We're required minimum things, just updates to the estimate, updates to make sure the plans and the details have ADA requirements that meet standard, those things. Those all those things help it score better, because it's you're already ready to go.
So I mean, I know there wants to be a longer streetscape phase two project, but I'm wondering if this is something we want to try and fast track, move it forward, or if we just want to consider the whole thing. Like I said, to do the whole thing, there's got to be a lot of design, engineering, and plans to create the project. But we've got a small section that could be done probably faster.
And that does add to the total cost too. And as I mentioned, there's a cap to the match. So
yeah,
kind of smaller projects. I mean, it's all what the board wants,
yeah,
ultimately. But if it's capped and you've already got a set of plans, that's not eating up engineering costs to design it. And you basically got something ready to go out to a contractor. And then maybe the next time you get a grant, you know, you can get the design on that. But it's really the choice.
Is that second piece, that little piece there that we already have the design for? What I'm hearing, though, it has to be in CIP, correct?
Well, I mean, we're in the process of doing CIP, so we can add, if we one, if we want to just add that one into the CIP, and then maybe we add, we'll call that Little Wood Pettit Foster Academy Road Phase 2, and maybe we call Phase 3 up a longer section or stuff like that, just something from the board to say that's where we want to go. Again, the original section, as I looked at the estimate to do that little piece, was, I think it was only about estimated at $60,000. Back in 10 years ago,
it's going to be high.
I'm certain it's going to be $60,000 in today's
money. I'm just, I guess I'm correct me where I'm going wrong here. At this, we would have to wait till next budget season to get it in this, that phase two in the CIP.
Well, we could get it in the CIP. I mean, again, so the TAP funding, when does those approvals?
So the pre-app would be spring of next year. And then you're looking at the final application cycle.
So we would have it
in the fall. Okay. So it basically, you've got smart scale in the evening years and TAP and revenue sharing in the in the odd years. So it runs on the same general cycle. So pre-app, and that's really, you want to have your projects generally well thought out and generally agreement that this is where we're going to move forward. And then from pre-app to final app is when you're really dialing those in, finalizing your budgets, so that when you come back with the agreements and the app A's and the resolution requests to make sure the funding is there, those are in September ready to go, and that's what you want to do. And then as applications go in, they go before the CTB, and then you'll know when you get funding, usually in the winter.
So just trying to get some direction. If we want to put the whole thing through or put it in kind of like a quicker, probably a higher scoring phase, and then
as long as they're separate items that don't kind of like, once that phase is completed, then we kind of forget about the rest. I would say break them up into separate items. If we're going to go after a grant for this first piece that we already have the design for, I don't know whether we call it phase two or phase three, but I would just say to lump it all together, I guess we can't get grant funding for all of it at the same time. Right. I guess my thought is if you have it as separate items, they don't get lost. So.
Yeah, I mean, you could have them as separate items in the phase two one, because the plans are basically already, again, there probably needs to be some updates, but you're talking probably minimal updates. Mm-hmm. And then, you probably have a higher likelihood of getting funding for that piece because the plan's already in place.
Well, then I would say yes. Don't want to speak for a lot of board members.
Yes, and what?
To kind of have it broken up in that manner in order to go after the grant for this first piece. I mean, it seems to me that it would make sense to, if the money's there, to go after the money. And if that's what we need to do to go after the money, that's what we should do.
Yeah. I know this has had a couple of prolonged conversations, and I'm going to read you a couple of messages I got Saturday. I said, well, good time for you to send them. Person said, please pass an ordinance to stop people putting signs in the roundabouts. Looks redneck. do something about the corner on 53 and Turkey Sag Trail where Food Line is. Same thing with the signs.
Yeah.
So, we've had a couple of these conversations.
They're not supposed to be there.
Yeah. And the last we talked about it, there was the board said something to the effect of that we were going to warn people or something. And whatever it was, I said, well, that's not going to do squat, and it's not doing squat, and it's a mess. So can you just revisit just quickly with two new board members here what our options are?
So there's an option that I believe we had talked about where the board can pass a resolution to essentially pick up the signs on behalf of the department, whether you have staff do that or whoever, and then charge a fine or a fee for those signs that you pick up. And I don't have the exact, I want to say it was like $100 a sign. Correct. Was it $100? Mm-hmm. And that's allowed by code, and it's a resolution that needs to be passed.
But you could just do that, and then, because my concern is you're not going to probably collecting fees, probably going to be
That's the challenge,
that's
right?
The challenge.
And that's the option if you want to.
But right now, could someone right now go onto the VDOT portal and say there's signs in
yes.
in your right of way, and then VDOT would go out and pick those up?
Yes, that is something we do. You could always go on, report a road problem, report the signs. We do that multiple times a day. We'll go in and look. It's considered like roadside litter. Of course, we also look at it as safety concerns first. So, you know, that at that roundabout, they'll ride through. If it's not a safety concern, they'll add it to the list. So when they're in there doing litter pickup, they'll pick the signs up. Now, if there's a larger sign, like, you know, sometimes during election season, we'll see a huge banner get put up and it's creating a sight distance issue, that sign's going to come down right away. If it's a small sign that's not really creating a safety issue, that sign might sit out there for a day or two before crews get out there. So there are several options available for it. You report a road problem, but if it's something where, you know, you want staff doing additional patrols, that's also an option too. And I'd be happy to resend that information if you don't need it.
One thing that we talked about that was kind of a hiccup with doing it that way was, what if we grab one that's not in the right way? And all of a sudden somebody's got a bit photo evidence of that we just took one 6 inches out of the right way. Mm-hmm. And now we're violating rights. I think that was one of the issues we talked about. Mm-hmm. And we don't have so much staff. And we're busy doing other stuff that if we try to give them, I think the biggest thing we talked about was getting the number and being able to pass that number out to anyone that if they want to go on the VDOT website or whatever it is,
right,
and report a sign being in a line of sight or something like that.
And like the roundabouts, because, you know, I see some of the mowing crews go out there and I see them mowing around the signs sometimes. Mm-hmm. Are they supposed to pick up those signs?
They should be picking those up. So if we've got issues on primaries where they're not, that's a call or an email to me.
Okay.
And we'll get that to you.
Like for instance, the roundabout at 53 in South Boston, I've seen signs there and I saw them out mowing one day and they mowed around them, and I think they may even weeded around them too.
Well, I can tell you right now, they have been removed in the past, because my first year I had a bunch of signs up and I would go down to the VDOT shop about once a month,
yeah,
just to pick my signs back up. Oh, sorry, put these in the wrong place, I'll take care of it.
Yeah, I mean, they will usually keep them for a little while. If there's a number on the back, they'll call and say, hey, we got your signs. I know, you know.
They saw me at E-Dubs.
Well, in some instances, we'll have, like, folks, like, churches will put out signs for fall festivals, things like that. They'll be, you know, creating sight distance issue. They'll call, somebody will call a church and be like, hey, put the sign in right away. It's creating sight distance issue. We're going to keep them for a week before we throw it away. Let the church come back and get the sign, things like that. A lot of the ones where it's, like, a, you know, a business that's promoting something or a, you know, we buy ugly houses type thing, you know, whatever that goes out, where they're just constantly putting out hundreds upon hundreds,
yeah,
of signs, that number never gets an answer. And, you know, we throw away 50 a day and there'll be 50 more. I can't remember the other board member I was talking to, but it was literally they went up 53, they went through the roundabout, they picked up the signs, they went up, turned around, came back, and somebody else was already out there putting the signs back up. And it was literally they were chasing them around like Monticello.
Other localities that have done this, I mean, has it worked? I mean, it sounds like we're concerned about a handful of areas, and, you know, think about it with speed. There are certain places that cops sit more often than other places. You know, is it a thing where if you pass an ordinance that you might enforce more in certain areas, such as at the Sagar roundabouts, than you would in other places?
It's already in this law. I mean, it's already a violation of the time. So you're not passing an ordinance saying it's against the law.
It was a fine. I mean, has that done anything to deter people from doing it?
In some instances, it has. I mean, there are localities around Fredericksburg, Chesterfield County that have these ordinances in place, and they actually have staff that they don't necessarily ride the whole county. But like Chesterfield County, for example, they ride around like the courthouse complex through the Route 10 area. And that's what that staff does. And I forget the name, I want to call it like the beautification committee or something like that. But
they're making enough money to pay for themselves.
But they are picking up signs all the time out there, and they hit the fine and Fredericksburg, for example, they do not charge a fine, but Fredericksburg has people that go and pick up the signs, but they do not charge a fine because the, you know, the juice isn't worth the squeeze at that point, because it costs them more to collect.
So we would be, it would be our staff enforcement.
It would be not very much juice coming out of the squeeze.
I mean, the only thing, I mean, going back to the right-of-way discussion that was discussed before with the board, I mean, if the board did something, I mean, I guess the one area that you could almost say is definitely in the VDOT right-of-way is roundabouts.
Roundabouts.
Right. I mean, that, I guess there would be no ambiguity of is it in the right-of-way or not, but I mean, I think that was some of the concerns that are elsewhere in the roadways and stuff.
I mean, I would, if the board chose to do it, my recommendation would be to do it in targeted areas instead of trying to do it countywide, because you would get into a situation on a secondary or even some of the primaries where it's variable width right away. That way, if you had a targeted section, we could provide that right away width in that targeted area, and then that section gets controlled. But then the question becomes, is that worth it?
About that section, not our section.
Or
I believe the question is, I can ask.
All the signs gone, Tom. So.
Says what?
Put a sign that says you're the person.
We can put a sign that says don't put your signs here.
As long as it's not in the right way.
I didn't get you to cut it in the grass, no sign.
I mean, clearly, places like Turkey Sand 53 are the chronic places. So to say, well, why don't you do it at mine? You know, you got to deal with where it's most prominent if you can. And if we did it in, say, for example, there, we would just have to check what the setbacks are once to be able to know from then on what we're dealing with. It's not like a hunt and peck with all the different ones around the county. And it's trash. I mean, it's to the point where it would not shock me if you're coming down from Lake Monticello at Turkey Sag 53, if there's 15 signs on the right there.
And there's at least 15 right now.
Yeah.
And they have the right of way or the personal property.
I would pretty much guarantee that quite a normal road.
And what happens when they turn and move them back on the private property?
Then it's up to the property owner. And
like I said, my biggest fear is that it's in that gray area that's close, and we all of a sudden remove 10 political signs, let's just say political, not so much the ones you're talking about, the houses or the roofing or the old junk cars, but we remove 10 political signs, and then we get sued by the candidate saying, these were on private property and you removed my sign.
Yeah. But I mean, we're not doing anything. We keep.
You would have the staff members take a picture of the signs before they remove them. So when I was in Warren County, we had an agreement with VDOT, and we had our zoning administrator go out primarily on the entrance corridors to remove all the signage. You put them in the back of his truck, keep them for a month, take pictures. We never actually took anyone to work to collect the fine, but it did help beautify the county, the entrance corridors at least. Yeah. And you knew on the entrance corridors, you know what the right of way is.
Yeah.
So it's easier to know that they're.
If you get a call from the county or someone puts something in the thing that says talks about signs, I mean, what is your all's process to go out and determine if it's in the right of way or not? I mean, is it?
Well, I mean, we kind of know where our right of way is just because the guys and ladies that work out there, you know, they've been out there for many years, so they'll know. If it's questionable, they'll usually call the office and you know, get somebody from our land use staff to look it up. But they have, you know, files, you know, they keep in the office. We have files that we keep in the office that we know. And, you know, they'll pick it up. I know last year when we were talking about this, I think one of the requests was, you know, for us to track it for like 2 or 3 weeks, what we would pick up. And I know between Zion Crossroads area headquarters and Palmyra area headquarters, they were picking it up anywhere from just in these roundabout areas around Lake Monticello, they were picking up anywhere from 80 to 90 signs a day. And they did a targeted push for 2 weeks where I literally had crews just circling the lake, picking them up. So it's a lot that gets put out there. And I think the hope was if we were just like taking the push, they would stop putting signs up, find somewhere else to put them. But like I said, they make a round and they were right back there putting signs up. So.
What are we saying? I mean,
we can. I mean, if the board wants us to, I mean, we can push it out to the public. I mean, we could certainly submit stuff to VDOT on.
Yeah, and we'll continue to pick them up. I'm not saying we're not going to pick them up. We're going to continue to keep doing it. We so, go, the harder we go after it, the harder they come.
So what's the only thing we're talking about here would be essentially, it sounds like, if we boil it down, the brass tacks would be whether or not we charge a $100 fine or not.
Well, you either have county or just citizens really kind of get behind submitting stuff through VDOT site. So the onus on removing the signs is VDOT. Or you do some type of resolution or ordinance or whatever you have to do for the county or county staff to have to do the sign removal. And then you'd have to determine if you want to charge a fee or not.
So if we did that, would VDOT then no longer be enforcing it and we would take on the enforcement?
Correct. The county staff would be the ones removing the signs. If we signed the agreement with VDOT, that's the resolution.
That seems to be putting a lot of pressure. I mean, I understand in theory, like if VDOT was still pulling up certain things, but if VDOT's just going to wash their hands of it, if we take it on, we have to ask ourselves if we have the capacity to do that and to do it in an efficient manner. You know,
but VDOT would still pull the signs when they're doing their mowing, their trimming operations.
And then any site distance issues and things like that. And again, if it was targeted areas, that could be part of the agreement too, right? Like, we're going to pick up signs everywhere else in the county, but...
So, if the county took it on, we could essentially, it would be blanket, but we could have area. I go back to the speed analogy. And someone said, well, why are you enforcing this area and not this area? Well, there's some places the cops sit more often than they sit other areas. They're enforcing speed. In other areas more than they're enforcing, speed in a certain area. I mean, so if we took it on, would it just be an understanding of like, hey, we're looking at these certain areas? And I guess my question would be, Eric, what would your response to that be? Is that something we can undertake at this point?
I mean, I guess it depends on how many areas we're looking at and you know, what is the staff? I just go back to what is going to be the time commitment. I mean, there's certain staff members. I mean, you have a limited amount of staff that are literally like doing rounds and driving around. It's not like you have a bunch of staff doing that. So my only slight concern is are we going to be able to do it efficiently?
You're not going to find it. They're not going to stop.
Did it not in the past be when Scott and Roger would go out doing soil and erosion or other normal things, build-in inspections, if they spotted an issue, they pull them up?
Well,
they weren't allowed to.
They weren't allowed to because there's no...
So they were just doing this off their own back?
I don't know. Someone might have been doing that. I don't know who was doing it.
I definitely know Roger was doing it. He told me about it.
Okay. No one asked me.
I'm not sure who was doing it. That was my answer to you.
So couldn't someone call a turkey sag and say there's signs in the way of VDOT would come pick them up?
Yes.
But it becomes a question of time, right, and the appetite for how long they're going to stay out there, because we're a safety first agency. So it's going to be evaluated against, is it a safety issue? If it is not a safety issue on the evaluation, it may be a day or two before the crew that's doing litter collection and mowing goes out there and actually removes the sign. So it's, you call me, I'm coming. But it may be a day or two, or especially if it's in the...
Sounds like it's taken down.
If it's within a day or two, guys, I mean, that's what we're talking about. If it's within a week, I'd be happy with
it. Right, and I mean, and generally, they're doing that. So, I mean, my work order closure time on things like that is less than 10 days. Site distance issues, it's usually the same thing.
My feelings on this is... We just kind of try to keep doing what we're doing, trying to take VDOT to let them know, and we spend a long time talking about signs.
And it's a recurring issue. We keep talking about
it. Even if we take them down, I mean, if you want to put $100 fine, we'll put it on there. But yeah. I mean, it's...
But then the enforcement's on us.
Then the enforcement's on us, and do we have the manpower to do that? And you look at each one of our branches of our government, we don't have enough manpower in each one to do those types of things. I mean, yeah, it helps, but... Will it pay for itself? Or are we going to hire a person to just ride around and pick up signs?
So, if I agree that we're spending a lot of time talking about signs, but because we're not doing anything different, they just keep doing the same thing, you're going to keep getting the same result. And it sounds like to me we were saying that if we were to target it, that would be us targeting it, the county, right, where we would notify.
Yeah, we would have to let VDOT know what area was our targeted pickup locations. And and then they're not going to pick up those locations.
I think in the order as business, we should let the presenters present, and then we want to bring this up with all the business we can. We should hold up them.
Yes.
We've got the information that we need from them.
All right, we'll see that. Everybody good with that?
Sure.
Thank you.
And if you need any information on this, feel free to email me and I can, you know, provide you anything or say anything.
Great.
Thank you. Bye, good night.
You too.
I'll have to discuss that.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Item B, 2024 Thomas Jefferson Planning District Legislative Program Updates. Mr. Blount.
I enjoyed the conversation. I understand you have an agenda. Afternoon, this is the afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Always good to be here with you all and appreciate the opportunity to be on your agenda. Also appreciate what you all do, your interest in succeeding in legislative. I wanted to spend just a couple of minutes tonight, if I could, just bringing you a very brief legislative update on a couple of different items, and then talk a little bit about the future legislative program as we move forward into 2025. I always like to talk about the budget first. The state budget, you know, took us, again, a little bit longer to get a budget this spring. Came out in May. You've probably heard within the last month or so the announcement of the close of fiscal year 24 at the state level. There was another surplus exceeding $1 billion, and I've already been hearing that as we move into the process of amending the state budget during this upcoming session, that they'll probably be looking to bump up the projected revenue. So it appears that for the General Assembly, when they start looking at the governor's recommendations, they'll have some additional resources to work with during January and February. The budget process is underway. You know, how early it begins here locally, same thing at the state level with the agencies looking at what requests they might want to make for changes to the state budget. That'll work its way over the next couple of months through the executive branch, and then I think by the time we get to December the 18th or so, the governor will be proposing changes to the current two-year state budget, and the General Assembly will take those up when it convenes in January. So always know there's a lot of interest in the budget, we'll be keeping an eye on those developments.
Can I make one comment?
Sure.
We'll steal from one of my colleagues on the board of directors, or you used to be on the board of directors. You don't have a surplus until your bills are paid.
Oh, I agree.
And looking at that first sentence, the bills aren't being paid.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, probably know the name Walter Stosch, who's a longtime senator from Henrico County. He was the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. He always talked about the bills in the drawer, and that's what they should be, you know, focusing their attention. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, surplus, call it that. They've said how it gets spent, but it's not coming back to, you know, things that we may like. It goes to different things. Legislatively, in terms of bills, there's I think a number of things are going on now this summer and into the fall that may in some ways drive some of the discussion during 2025. It seems like there's a lot of committees and JLARC looking at a number of things. There is a subcommittee that's going to be taking a look at the JLARC K-12 education report from last summer. They're actually having their first meeting next week. JLARC is busy. They are looking at the state's implementation of broadband, which, you know, we've been heavily involved with you all in Firefly on that. Both Gary Wood and myself had an opportunity to talk with JLARC staff about that project. They're also looking at data centers and the impacts that data centers could pose. And both of those reports are going to be given sometime, I think, in November or December. There's a state commission, individual legislators, other stakeholder groups that are looking at energy generation and siting. I know that you all have been rolling up the sleeves and have been very deep into that, and will continue to be in terms of your solar siting discussions. And then there were a number of issues from this past General Assembly session in the affordable housing arena that did not go forward that are getting some review in the Virginia Housing Commission. I think a lot of those issues we may see legislation not the same as we saw last year, but reworked and have to deal with that during this kind of session. I'll do just maybe spend 30 seconds as a refresher, since we have, and I guess anything with your new members, so that you know, I do come out to all of the local governments in September to talk about legislation, legislative update, the legislative program, get some input from you all as to things that we would want to see in the regional legislative program, do the drafting, make those changes, send that back out to you all, and then I'll come back to you in November to talk about the changes that we made to get your approval of the program. So I would certainly appreciate any suggestions you all have, any comments you may have. I did include in your packet just a summary of the top three legislative priorities from this past session. Don't know that I would anticipate that those top three priorities would change, but if there's anything that you all would like to see done differently, or suggestions for different language, I'd be glad to talk with you all about that, and of course try to answer any questions you have.
Okay. I'll say I appreciated your help with the solar siting bills and the direction you gave, and so on.
Yeah, I think I'm going to probably look to strengthen some of the positions we have in the Congress as well.
Well, thank you. Anything from staff?
Right. Thank you all.
Appreciate you, sir. All right. Moving on to consent. Anybody? Surplus Palmyra Fire Tanker Truck, Mr. Dalton.
Let's give a quick update. So again, Palmyra Fire ordered a new truck in January 23, a fire truck. It's funded in the 22 CIP. A replacement apparatus was deemed surplus, which is a 2000 Freightliner tanker. And again, it's general practice in Savannah that's surplus, and it's also policy too that surplus property can be sold at auction, generally through gov deals. And then, so under our policy, county policy 4.3 surplus property, and under 4.3.6 more specifically, surplus property and surplus vehicles, subject to the disposition of surplus property by sale, exchange, or trade. All sales of surplus property and surplus vehicles should be based upon competitive principles, and if feasible, shall be sold on the basis of competitive bids to obtain the best price and ensure that the county receives fair market value. As the board knows, Drake's Branch Volunteer Fire Department, which is in Charlotte County, made a request to purchase one of the Palmyra tanker trucks that the county has as surplus. Drake's Branch asked if we bypass the auction process and sell directly to them because they had an emergent need and limited resources. From the last board meeting, the board wanted staff to kind of get some idea of what fair market value was for the truck. So the county reached out to Fesco Emergency Sales. We have purchased apparatus from Fesco previously. And so they gave us a used vehicle proposal, which values the vehicle at $26,000. So options before the board for the sale of our surplus property is, one, you just strictly follow what the surplus property is, and so we would sell it as we normally have under gov deals, and then whatever price is set, that's the price that we sell it for. Under gov deals, you can set a minimum price that you want to get for that vehicle as well. The sellers through gov deals have to pay what's it called? It's like a premium charge that the sellers pay through gov deals for it being sold through gov deals. Option two is the board of supervisors could waive the competitive principles process under surplus policy 4.3, and the tanker truck is sold at the used proposed value from Fesco, which I would consider the fair market value, since it was valued at that of $26,000. Or more to whatever interested party. So in this circumstance, the county would set the sales price at $26,000 or something above that price, and negotiate that amount with Drake's Branch Volunteer Fire Department. Then option three, and again, I wouldn't recommend option three, but it's an option as well, just for the board. The county can sell the tanker truck below fair market value to an interested party. And again, while this variation of flu mandate normal practices, it's variations of flu mandate practices, flu mandate may make gifts, so to speak. So if you sell a piece of equipment for less than what its fair market value is directly without a competitive process, you're basically gifting that portion that you're not getting the value from to another agency. But the county could do that. So those are really the three options in front of the board. Stick to the policy, sell it for at least the $26,000 or more directly to Drake's Branch, or you could sell it below. And you want to add anything to that, Mr. Witten?
No, I mean, we have three options in front of you, basically. The policy's in your packet. So option two or three, you'd be waiving the policy.
Yeah.
Determining if you want to offer it at fair market value or below fair market value.
So I think, if I recall, there was a number put out there somewhere between 25 and 35,000. Is that correct, or 30,000? I don't know. I feel like there was an higher number that was mentioned.
Mr. True, do you want to pop up real quick? And I know some board members spoke to the chief of Drake Branch.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Maybe it was you that had mentioned last time that, you know, kind of the range.
In discussion, that there was an estimate somewhere between $25,000 and $30,000 was where the discussion. That was prior to the actual written agreement that came in for Fesco's, putting the actual amount at 26.
Right.
I think there's a few things that have to be done to it.
There is some repair. I don't exactly know what it is.
There's some repairs that have to be made.
Right.
I have no problem doing it for 26. That's what they say it's worth.
Yeah, I mean, at auction, if the variance is between 26 and 30,000, at auction, we would pay almost that differential.
That's it, if you got that.
Well, we would pay the fees, the buyer. I'm sorry, I think I said sellers before the buyers pay the fees. I apologize. I think I said sellers.
So, I have a question on this. Are we still on the as is with ladders and dump tank, or just the vehicle? Did the proposal come back to include the equipment on the vehicle, or just the vehicle itself?
The vehicle itself.
So are we keeping the dump tank and the ladders?
I am not aware of the dump tank or the ladders.
Yeah.
The request that we sent to Fesco was for the vehicle.
Not to include equipment?
It didn't, and there was nothing mentioned in the conversation about equipment. The pictures that were taken, the mileage, all of that, the actual quote was for the vehicle itself.
And it would be sold as is, whereas.
Yeah. I mean, what would we do with the, I mean, I know you can pull the ladder off and use the ladder at the firehouse. What would you do with the
dump tank?
Keep all the
bags.
Okay.
So you must be able to get the stuff off.
Why would we take it off at every fire scene?
The tank?
Yeah. The dump tank.
Not the tank off the truck.
The red bag on the side.
The red bag on the side, we can set up, it's about a 10 by 10, 3 foot deep tank. Portable tank.
I know, Jason. You were saying tank, and I was seeing.
You're doing the big metal thing?
So that's not just fit for use on
the ranch.
No, you set it on the ground, you fill it with water,
okay.
And pull off it.
Yeah, so maybe I can pull up with my tanker and just dump my entire tanker into that thing.
All right.
So we're
talking 2 minutes.
We're talking about the truck taking the
right.
Yeah.
I'm all for option two at the going rate.
I am as well. That's the one where we just sell it in for $26,000.
That's the fair market value.
That's the fair market value for it. And it gets in the truck and it gets us a fair market value.
I agree. And it's in that, as I said to Eric, I mean, bird in hand, it's, I don't know if the auction would get less of it. And so
that's why.
I said, I think you have
a motion. Okay. I move the Board of Supervisors approve the sale of surplus for the 2000 Freightliner tanker truck by one, two. Waive the competitive principles process under surplus policy 4.3, and the tanker truck is sold at the used proposed value, fair market value from Fesco of $26,000.
Second.
I don't think we need to.
Well, when we say tanker truck, it doesn't say with accessories and equipment. It just says truck. So it would just be the.
So, motion made by Mr. Sheridan, second by Mr. Hodge. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye.
When would you want to check?
What's that?
When would you want to check?
I don't know. I'll reach out to the chief from Drake's branch, just let him know what the, by some formal letter, what the board decided on, and then we'll just arrange it from there.
Yeah, I would think you should get some sort of.
I think he's reached out to him.
He might be.
We need some kind of sale.
Yeah.
Bill sale.
Yeah. I mean, there's some formal, there's some official thing for it to have to do on our side.
He just sent him a message and said, let me know when you need to check.
Yep.
All right, now the consent agenda. Anybody have anything to pull?
No.
Okay.
I believe that we adopt the consent agenda as seconded.
Motion made by Mr. Goode, seconded by Mr. Hyde. All in favor?
Aye.
4 votes, 5-0. All right. Any new business?
The unfinished business.
Oh, unfinished business, yeah.
So last night the solar committee met, I believe that was the fifth time we met, fourth or fifth. So we met to discuss recommendations from the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission had met in August to look at the ordinance, and they had a few tweaks to the ordinance that I presented to the committee. Then the committee made a few more tweaks last night. So the public hearing at Planning Commission will be next Tuesday, and then it will come back to the board in October, the second meeting in October. So I kind of wanted to go over the ordinance, where it is right now after the Planning Commission and the committee comments. So as you know, on July 3rd, the board approved the amendment to remove utility scale solar generation as a use allowed by special use permit in the A1 district. So the committee's been working on the new proposed S1 solar district. And at first we discussed that the district would be within a certain distance from high transmission lines, but ultimately they decided to make it as an option available countywide for rezoning. So the creation of the new district, basically, it keeps a lot of the by right A1 uses that are related more to agricultural purposes, and also many of the SUP uses that are related more to agricultural uses. And also under SUP has minor scale solar generation facilities and major utilities, and then also the utility scale solar generating facilities. If you have any questions as we're going along, just stop me. So the supplemental regulations, that was the big section that the committee's really been working on. So the new chapter, Article 28, basically deals with supplemental regulations for utility scale solar generation facilities, or USSGFs, short. So the maximum size for any solar facility, utility scale solar facility, would be 500 acres, and that would be the project area for the facility. And no more than 3% of the total county acreage, which is approximately 5,400 acres, could be used for utility scale solar. And the one change we made is no more than 1% of the total county acreage can be within each election district. So of the five districts, you can have a max of 1,800 acres per election district, but still the total countywide is 5,400 acres.
I cover your whole district.
Yeah. Well, my district won't have it.
So the other change we made, what the committee suggested last night, regarded setbacks. So it's 500 feet from dwellings on adjacent parcels. They did make a change. It would be 375 feet from adjacent property lines and 300 feet from public right-of-ways. And it would actually be 500 feet from the entrance corridors, which are 6, 15, 53, and 250. And it would be 1,000 feet from the James River, Rivanna, and Hardware Rivers, and all lakes. So it would be Lake Monticello, Virgin Lake, And then 500 feet from all ponds and perennial streams. And then we would require a landscape buffer, vegetative buffer of 175 feet, which would be within the required setback and around the whole perimeter. And so they can either use the existing forest buffer, new vegetative screening or berms, or a combination of all three. And performance bonds would be required to ensure the maintenance of the buffers. It would only be released after decommissioning. The maximum height would be 28 feet for all equipment, and the maximum, except for substations, but the maximum height for the poles and the solar panels would be 20 feet. It also must be enclosed by a 6-foot-high fence with opaque screening, which would still allow access for wildlife. And the outdoor lighting would have to be shielded and dark sky compliant. And also the solar panels would be designed and placed to prevent glare on adjacent properties. So as far as signage, so basically there would only be signage at the access points, and it wouldn't be allowed on the fencing or buildings unless it was required by federal law or state law. And the emergency access will be provided in at least two separate access points. The one thing we did remove was the 20-foot requirement on the aisles for emergency equipment, because after discussing it, we realized that really it made more sense to fight the fire from the perimeter rather than going into the facility. And so we had an in-depth discussion about that. Construction activity would be limited from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. So wiring and all distribution transmission lines would be underground, and new transmission lines would be subject to a plan of development review. And all wires located on the poles of the panels would be located in conduit. If the project's 50 acres or greater, they have to have a wildlife corridor plan. And basically all areas between fencing need to be open so that wildlife can move through those areas. So a landscaping plan would be required with each application, and the intent would be to maximize the preservation of existing trees, and it also include a tree inventory for existing trees, and the existing plant material can be a mix of evergreen and deciduous trees. For the new buffers, we prefer native and pollinator-friendly plant species, and the evergreens, conifers, have to have a minimum height of 8 feet, and deciduous trees have to have a minimum 2-inch caliper on the trunk. And all landscaping has to be shown on the approved plan. So vegetative management plan, they're required to show a description of the ground cover and the plan to manage that, keep it cut, and also only biodegradable sip and water needs to be used for cleaning the surfaces. As far as the ENS plan, it has to be approved by the Soil and Water Conservation District and DEQ prior to land disturbance. And no topsoil can be removed from the site and has to be used on site. An applicant could be required to find a third-party ENS inspector, which is by the planning director. And the other aspect we're adding is the BMPs from the white papers developed by Virginia Tech. So that was one suggestion last night. Instead of just referencing the white paper, have specific BMPs from the white paper. So I'm going through all those BMPs, there's about 40 of them, to see which ones are most relevant to what we're trying to do with this ordinance. So we'll present all those specific BMPs at the Planning Commission on Tuesday. Panels can't be installed on slate from steep slopes, which are 20% or greater. And we require an impact analysis for all historical and cultural resources, including grave sites. So all resources have to be identified and protected. Groundwater monitoring has to take place before construction and after completion, and every 5 years during the operation and after decommissioning. And the owner has to provide the plan director an emergency management plan for all phases of the facility. Emergency personnel has to have the Knox box key or code to access the property. And all plans and training need to be coordinated with Louisiana Fire and Rescue. Decommissioning, the plan has to be submitted and approved before permit issuance. It needs to be updated every 5 years. And if the facility is not active for 6 months, then it needs to be decommissioned at the expense of the owner. And there will be a surety agreement in the full amount of the decommissioning cost, which will be submitted before the building or land disturbing permits issued, unless Dominion owns the facility, then they don't require a surety agreement. It would not be required. And the panels have to be recycled at a certified recycling facility. And also one other thing is the panels have to be disposed of outside the county. They can't be disposed of in the county convenience sites. Are there any questions? But one other thing in the intent statement, we added language that battery storage is not allowed, just to make it clear that that's not an allowed use in the county.
Can you say that one again?
So in the intent language, statement of intent for the ordinance with supplemental regulations, we added language that battery storage is not an allowed use. Because the way our ordinance reads, we only show the uses that are allowed. We don't show uses that are not allowed. We want to make it clear in the intent language that battery storage is not allowed use. So there's no question, no interpretation question, that battery storage is a separate use from a utility scale solar facility.
Thank you. And yeah, these are the recommendations of the solar committee. They're going to be pushing these recommendations forward to the planning commission, who will consider the supplemental regulations and the ordinance next Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Just wanted to give the board this kind of a little sneak preview. Again, certainly once it gets to the planning commission, some of these items could potentially change by the time it gets to the board, but this is kind of where things lie at this point. If the board is interested, we could send you the draft ordinance just for your review, just to see the entire ordinance in its entirety if you want prior to then. But like so, just wanted to give you a little something to kind of see where things are. And, you've got a couple solar committee members here that can make any comments if they want, or Mr. Chair, however you want to proceed.
Well, I would say that if you get making comments, it's likely leading to more comments. So I would suggest if there are any comments, they're not very deep and short.
The only point that came out of our discussion was something new, was that on the setbacks, if we raise the number on the setback at any point, we have to re-advertise the hearing. If we reduce the number, then we don't have to re-advertise it.
Yeah, from advertising a public hearing, if something's more
restrictive.
If you make something more restrictive, you have to re-advertise, but if you make it less restrictive, you don't.
And the other discussion around setbacks was, the commission had kind of listed a consensus, no, it wasn't a majority.
Yeah, I mean, so for instance, when we bring this to the planning commission and to the board, even though those numbers were on there for the setbacks, we may give a range of what the, just to kind of go back.
For clarity, I think you meant the committee.
Right.
Yeah, the committee. I mean, like, for instance, on here, someone may have said 375 from adjacent property lines, but there may have been, 200 to 375, but the majority wanted 375, but we'll provide some ranges of where kind of the committee ended up on some of these items.
Well, the only other thing, I actually didn't read the last slide, but I wanted to highlight when issuing the special use permit, the board can waive or modify any of the requirements of the ordinance. So if the board wanted to have a different setback than the ordinance, you could do that as a condition within the SUP.
And the one example that was given for examining the current setbacks that were previously proposed prior to the change that we made here would have resulted in only 80 acres of 430 acres being able to be used as an underground, just to give some sense as to how the exponential aspect of the setback lines can play. So that was pretty much the bulk of our discussion.
I have one question. I'll make more than one, but one right now, just to make it
will sit on, or is that the whole property that you use, including the setback? That would be my question.
Within the fenced in area, the project
area.
Well,
if they just put the fence around the panels, it would just be the panels.
Right, it does not include all the setbacks.
You'd have all the setback land.
So that's the same language that the General Assembly proposed, basically 4% project area. So that's the language that we discussed, was basically the project area. So it would not include the setback area.
All right.
So I think what you were asking there, just to clarify, was if you've got, let's call it 500 acres, but only 300 of it are because of spacing or this or that, it's 500, not 300, correct?
No, it's 300.
It's 300.
Okay.
So it's within the fence.
What's within the fence?
Yeah.
But you also have to remember wherever the panels are setting. We did say all the way around the perimeter, because we didn't have 20 feet between the rows, that there has to be 20 feet of drivable space all the way around the site from engines to tankers inside the fence.
There should be more than 20, because you don't want them that close to the panels. If you don't want them that close to the panels,
yeah,
it probably should be 60 feet. So we can not lose fire from it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, turning the corner with a long.
Well, I mean, turn the corner. That little fire, we don't want to drive right there.
Right, against the fence.
All right. Anybody, anything else? We'll talk about this on the night. Right.
That's why I said I'm just only asking one of my questions. That was it.
All right, and then on all business, let's wrap this Saturday. Is there, obviously, Turkey Sag is an issue. If we were to switch zones or areas, are there other ones that come to mind?
I think maybe this calls for you as if we actually acted on this previously. I don't know.
It would be under new business because it wasn't advertised. I mean, it went on prior. So okay. I think it would
have. But either way, that's just
I will say one thing going back to the fire truck. $26,000 was good without the other equipment.
Okay, well, let's go to new business and then talk about it there. What zones are there? Are there zones other than Turkey Sag that people want to focus on?
I mean, it sounded like in the conversation it was basically Turkey Sag and the roundabouts. I mean, I haven't gotten any,
yes.
Obviously, I don't, you know.
If you think from Effort Church Roundabout, it's Effort Church Roundabout, right outside the Monch Gate, then Turkey Sag, then the next roundabout, and they even put them in the roundabout ground here. Now, I know the land at the corner, when the Browns guys mow, they tend to pull them up, except for the ones for Palmar Arts
Festival. Yeah.
But it is an eyesore, and when you consider 53s, a store,
a highway,
yeah, that it just looks bad.
You know, one thing I thought of when I was sitting here, and I'm not sure if there's a way to do this, but so we have something called a litter grant that we get every year, and I don't think we utilize all the funding every year, so I don't know what is allowable under that, but I was just thinking of maybe there is a way to utilize some of the litter grant funding we have, because again, I guess you could say that the signs, if they're sitting on the side of the road, I guess technically they're litter. And so one of my thoughts was, and again, I had to check this out a little bit, but maybe there's a way to pay someone on a very small part-time basis to pick up the litter that's on the road.
So is that a grant that goes away after a certain time?
It's a grant we get every single year. I would say it's maybe 20 to 25,000 we get, and we use it for some other things. But maybe there's a way to utilize some of that funding.
To certainly, we're checking.
Could you do it to a nonprofit that could raise money and once a month go through that section and just pull signs?
Possibly, and that's one thing. Using the litter grant, I would have to see who or how we could pay. Could we pay a nonprofit group to go pick up signs if they wanted to use the money for whatever they're doing, or would it have to be someone like we hire a part-time staff person? Mr. Spitzer just corrected me. I'm sorry. It's only $6,000 a year, so it would have to be a pretty limited amount. But if, 6,000.
challenge is that if you're not putting sort of catches you both ways. If you put a fine on it, when you apply the fine, that's great. Those people will go away unless some people come in and maybe do it again. But then thinking you're complacent again, and then you start the process all over again. So, you know, if you're in the process of doing fines, that's one thing. But the problem with doing the fines, when we discussed this previously, was that the bang for the buck wasn't really there, because at some point in time you've done it. I think Mr. Fairchild made this point earlier, well, now you've done it, they're not gonna do it again. You know, was I think the point that you made. True, that may be the case, but you know, I think that's the only real way to win on this is you apply the fines or you don't apply the fines. If you don't apply the fines, you don't win.
What I'm thinking about, if you're talking about just that 53 quarter at the Turkey Sand Gate in the three circles,
yeah.
I can tell you right now, you got different groups at the high school that will run a concession stand to make $125, $150, $200, something like that. If we pay a group $200 a month to say, once a month, we need you to go pull these signs, clean the signs up in these four areas. And that would not take a whole lot of time.
A concern to me would be if we potentially have legal issues regarding setbacks, mm-hmm. than to have volunteer kids measuring and pulling compared to...
Well, that's with a nonprofit. You're leaving your enforcement measures to someone that's not an agent of who's the one that wants to do the enforcing in the first place.
One other comment, if we were to have fines, we're just going to send a letter, that's fine, but if you're going to take it to court, enforce that fine, mm-hmm. you'd have to subpoena that person at court to testify that yes, I pulled up that sign, yes, it was within the right of way. I'm not sure nonprofits.
No, you wouldn't want to do that. If we're going to charge a fine, we wouldn't want to do that. But are we going to make enough money to pay a part-time employee to do that?
I don't know. And I think I just need to see what all the limitations are of the litter grant. And I need to just hone in on that, because me and Mr. Smith are just texting back and forth here some amounts. So I just want to confirm all the amounts and confirm what it potentially could be used for. Because maybe there's a way to use that to pick up the signs because it's litter. And maybe it's you pay someone, I don't know, 4 hours a week to pick it up on a, I don't know, I don't know what the hot day is to put out signs.
Yeah,
for
Thursday nights and Fridays.
To that point, if you're paying them, let's just say, I mean, that's a completely hypothetical and you want, but VDOT said they could get out there and get them in 1 to 2 days. So if someone self-reported them, what's the point of using the litter grant for that if VDOT's gonna go do it anyways? And now we're basically asking for more work that the state's doing for us. If we could just have, and I'm sympathetic to what you're doing because I've heard you bring this up before I was on this board, and you're trying to answer a constituent concern and give a definitive answer, and I sympathize with that. I think, you know, is telling that person, well, this is actually enforced by VDOT. If you file, if you were to go to this website and report this, then within 1 to 2 days, VDOT's going to come out. Is that a sufficient enough answer for you as that person's representative to call that constituent back and say,
yeah, so I agree with you. I thought about that earlier and got about that. If VDOT's going to take care of it, but can't we be the ones who let VDOT know instead of the citizen?
We can go to the portal.
Yeah, we can. I mean, again, if someone sends something to us, here's the thing. If someone's reaching out to us, it's probably just as quick for them to go on the VDOT portal because it's really quick. And I'm not saying we won't do it. If someone sends something in, we will certainly do it.
Well, let me say, what I meant more was, if it's once a month, somebody drives from Palmyra to the Colonial Circle and back and says, hey, meet up, here's where they are, getting a staff member.
Well, I mean, so here's the thing.
Because I don't want to leave it on citizens who are concerned about it and us go, hey, if you just call or email on this site or whatever, I think we have a responsibility of something that's becoming an issue for us to take care
well,
of.
I don't want to volunteer someone else to help me out with something, but I drive by all the two of them probably 2 or 3 times a day.
Yeah.
That's one option. If someone else sees something, they can let us know.
But we gotta be careful about this, right? Because if we're not doing fines, then what's going to happen tired of us continually counting on this. And they're going to, you know, basically say, why are we doing this? But he himself said, he said, literally, we're pulling up signs and they're putting them down as we're pulling up signs. It's a little bit of whack-a-mole going on. And, you know, I want to be cognizant of VDOT's time, because it's still a state employee and pay their taxes. Staff's time, you know, county employee and pay their taxes. You know, we pay taxes as local citizens for that. And if we're not, really going to get, you know, to that end point, I think, yeah, maybe we'll clear up the problem for a few months or a week or two or whatever, but it's going to keep on coming back, so.
I believe everything Scott says, but there are signs on the corner of Turkey's Egg that have been there for a long time. There's something not happening.
It's an exponential problem. When there's no signs there, they tend to go weeks without them. And then once you get one or two down, the people that drop them spot them, oh, I guess it's okay, nobody's pulling them up, and then they just grow. It's only in the last 2 weeks. There's at least 15 signs down there now. And that's because the first two or three that were there a month ago, the other got pulled up. So Monash Gate's the same way.
Can I make a suggestion? Maybe do we try to, unless the board really wanted to go the resolution route, I mean, do we, one, just maybe give it a little trial through the end of the year of if staff sees it, or if you know, the board wants to notify staff of, hey, you know, because like for me, I don't drive by the roundabout up at my Effort or Monash Gate, or, and so they want to let us know, hey, we see this, we can go on the portal, we can submit it, and just see if it makes any dent in it at all, maybe through the end of the calendar year, just as a quick little test case. And at the same time, I can look into the litter grant options to see what's allowable from that.
That makes sense.
I think before we see something that the state's willing to do for us and take on more, that we try that. And then to Mr. O'Brien's point, if we know that they're going and pull them up and they keep getting blocked out, we know that that enforcement measure of just pulling them up is not enough. I can tell you, you know, we probably all five of us here at some point had a sign pulled up out of the VDOT right away. And I would go put it back down and then get pulled back up, and I'd stop putting it there because I didn't want to waste the money of putting another sign. I mean, they're not cheap. So maybe the enforcement measure is getting what you paid for scooped up. And I guess if you go to VDOT and pick them back up, that's, you know, you haven't lost any money.
My only question about putting $100 on it, how much would it cost to fight that in court?
I mean, you'd have my time going to court. I'll give you an example. I was in court recently on a noise violation. I sat here downstairs for 2 hours, and then the case was continued. And I went back, sat, it continued again. So that's the problem.
So let's, sounds like we're saying to have staff.
No, to put the request into the portal.
Yeah, and staff will review that corridor, as will other.
Yeah, I mean, again, I drive by the roundabout right down here. I drive by the one that's, you know, South Boston. I drive by.
Mr. Hodge would drive by.
Yeah, Turkey Side
on his way home. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you go
six
home
days
that way.
Yeah. I'll call him.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll get Chief Constantine.
He's out on even more than me.
I would just recommend if a supervisor or someone else is reporting, it's let staff know. So there's a double reporting.
I think we should let staff know.
Yeah.
Let staff, I think, know. A supervisor or whoever should let staff know so that that's not happening. Then it's, because if it starts becoming supervisor would, but then staff would in this case, and so on, it just becomes, I prefer it's in staff's hands.
When absentee voting starts, you don't see the more signs.
Yeah.
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 So maybe we
I think it was up in Alexandria, I think, during election season. And pretty much all of the medians were signed,
yeah.
Right? I think you couldn't drive a mile without seeing 500 signs. And they have staff.
we don't have enough staff to be.
Yes, well,
I don't think we have enough staff to be doing.
I think maybe it's a test case just to see, do we see any dent in the signs?
Right.
Doing it. I mean, again, I drive by every day, so if I see one there, you know, tomorrow and I report it, you know, 2 days later and they go out, I can see how quick. Because I I recognize the names on the signs, so I can see how quickly the repeat offenders are putting signs out there.
All right, I think we have a direction.
We need this.
What, in December we'll look at?
Yeah, we can maybe just, you know, we can just see if we think that this process is working to put a dent or hinder those signs.
Okay.
What I can do too, I can also look at that litter grant just to see if there's any opportunities, you know, in the meantime too.
All right, we will now open our second round of public comment. Anybody wishing to address the board, please come to the podium, state your name and address. Please remember to keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic directed to the board. Anybody wishing to address the board?
Not going to become a habit, but.
I think 2 times in a row is a habit.
Tony O'Brien, 3rd Chatham Lane. If you could just take a moment to recognize an individual that served the county, lived in the county briefly, but served the county both as a district representative for Good and Ella Payne, and also served the county as a marketing and communications person. He passed away on Monday. He was a dear friend, so I just recognize Greg Kelly.
Greg Kelly's?
Yeah.
Thank you. Anybody else? Seeing none, we will close the second round of public comments. We will now go to close meeting.
Close meeting. Mr. Chair, I move the Savannah County Board of Supervisors to enter into closed meeting pursuant to provisions of Section 2.2-3711A5, Section 2.2-3711A8, the Code of Virginia 1950 of the Act for the purpose of discussing prospective industry, prospective business updates in the Fort Union District, and legal matters, contract, and grants, and sure water and sewer ordinance.
Second. Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Goode. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0.
Mr. Chair, I move the closed meeting be adjourned and the Savannah County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge one or more public business matters lawfully exempted from the open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and two, only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Sheridan. Mr. O'Brien?
Aye.
Mr. Hodge?
Aye.
Mr. Goode?
Aye.
Mr. Sheridan?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. 5-0.
Motion adjourned.
Second.
Hey, no, he got beat to it. Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Hodge. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. 5-0. I thought you were getting done with that. I'll let you.